Let's turn to John 19, verse 16. That's in page 1087. John 19, we'll start from verse 16. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified, the crucifixion of Jesus. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side and Jesus in the middle. Verse 19. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read the sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, "Do not write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be the King of the Jews." Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, dividing them into four shares, one for each of them, with the undergarment remaining. The garment was seamless, woven in one place from top to bottom.
Thank you very much. Do keep those few verses open there for you. Have any of you seen The Passion of Christ, Mel Gibson's film? One, two people? Okay, a few people. I haven't seen it. But it basically goes through the events that you have been looking at over the last few weeks, the hours leading up to Jesus' death. As I said, I haven't seen it. I just don't think I could stomach the violence that is in it. And I guess that's the main thing that people will remember from that film, and that's commented about. It's the sheer brutality that's seen in it. And this is what some people say, some critics have said. They said, "The most violent film I have ever seen," which for people who probably look at a lot of films, is saying something. Another one puts it like this: "The Passion of Christ will leave many viewers emotionally drained rather than spiritually uplifted." So it really focuses on the barbarity of what happened. And Mel Gibson replied with this: "I wanted it to be shocking, and I wanted it to be extreme, so that they see the enormity of what the sacrifice, to see that someone could endure that and still come back with love and forgiveness, even through extreme pain and suffering and ridicule. The actual crucifixion was more violent that was shown on the film, but I thought no one would get anything out of it." So he says he could have made it even more graphic. And I suppose you could sympathize with that view. He's trying to show that the cross is a big deal. And what Jesus did, and he does that by focusing on the suffering. And that's not unique to Mel Gibson. We see that a lot in the arts. Think through the centuries of all those paintings about the crucifixion, focusing on that physical suffering. Think about how it's been preached in our pulpits too, focusing on the physical suffering in our sermons, maybe even in the hymns that we sing, drawing out the enormity of what Jesus has done through the suffering and the way it was done. And I suppose as I was preparing myself, I did a bit of reading about the crucifixion, the historical accounts about it, and the details of the sadistic skill of the Romans and what it did to the body of the condemned. And it made me feel physically sick. I had to get up and go and get some fresh air. And so when we come to our passage today, with that in mind, I think there's a bit of a shock in store for us. Look at the way John describes those events. Verse 18. This is how he describes it. "They crucified him." Just three words, that's it. He doesn't go into any detail, not a step-by-step of what happens, what the soldiers did, what it was like for Jesus. They crucified him. Now, why on earth would he do that? It's not like John is in a hurry. He's managed to slow down the action in some of his accounts before and give us a lot of detail when he wants to. Think of some of the speeches Jesus makes. Raising Lazarus from the dead, whole chapter. Dinner with the disciples the night before, they get five chapters. So is he just a little bit heartless? Well, of course not. He was there. He was there at the cross. He witnessed the barbarity more than we could know. And yet he just says they crucified him. Why would he do that? And I guess it's because if you were to focus on the savagery of what happened, by playing on our emotions and trying to arouse our pity, well, that would distract us from another point that John is trying to make, something that he really wants us to see. He doesn't want us to be distracted by the horror, because he wants us to see the true horror of the cross. And that's the first thing I want us to look at today. What is the true horror of the cross, the true scandal? Well, yes, the suffering is serious, but there's something far more serious that's going on. They crucified him. Him, the loving Son of God, the perfect man who was declared innocent three times in his trial, is then rejected, abandoned, condemned, and dies. He died because of sin, and it's because of your sin and because of my sin. And he died in our place. It's the greatest travesty of justice the world has ever seen. Think back to some of the scandals we've had recently, maybe the post office scandal where postmasters were sent to jail for stealing things they hadn't done when people knew it all along. Or the Windrush scandal, deporting people who had every right to be in this country, who'd made it their home all their lives. Or any other injustice you've heard of. Think about the pain it's caused, the anger that you feel when you hear about it. Think about the hurt. And yet here, we have something which is truly off the scale in comparison. Because the one who created the world, who loved it, who made all of us who are in it, well, he's the one who's then condemned, and we have caused his death. We're not very good at thinking about it this way, are we? We know that we're not perfect. Yes, we don't get everything right, but we're pretty decent most of the time. And there are people who are far worse than us, aren't there? Remember how John put it back in chapter 1? He, talking of Jesus, was in the world, and the world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. Well, in our series, we've been seeing how the Jews, God's very own people, and the leaders, the chief priests, well, they've rejected him and have him killed. Of all the people, they should have been the ones to recognize him, his own. But instead, what did they say back in verse 15 last week? Take him away, crucify him. We have no king but Caesar. But it's not just them, because, of course, we have all been made in his image. We are all his own. And so whether we call ourselves a Christian today or not, well, we have fallen short because we've rejected him, or we've not lived by his own standards, by keeping his law perfectly. And that's our sin. And it's our sin that has led him to the cross. That is the true scandal of the crucifixion, far more than just the physical suffering and the horrors he endured. Do we see that about ourselves? The seriousness of what we've done? The shocking evil that it leads to? Think back maybe during lockdown, what it was like, rules of, you know, what you could do and couldn't do, who you could see. It was really tough. And particularly for people maybe who weren't able to say goodbye to loved ones. Think of our own late queen, sitting on her own as she was burying her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh. And then it turns out that all along, some of the people who've been making the rules, well, they've been breaking them. Matt Hancock, Boris Johnson, you know, the blatant disregard. Now think back how many times you've talked about what they've done. Maybe all the conversations you've had, maybe mocking them, but at least talked about it. What they did was truly appalling. But then compare it to what we have done to the Lord of the whole universe. Do we talk about it anywhere near as much as we do those two fellows? Do we talk about it with the same fervor and the same repulsion? There is nothing that comes close to what we have done that our sin has caused. And I guess that is a reflection of how maybe little we see our sin. And that is the true horror, the true scandal of the cross. But as we come to the cross, notice also how Jesus goes to it, because he doesn't do it in a helpless way, but he does it in a willing way. He willingly became the sacrifice. And that's our second point, that Jesus is the willing sacrifice. Let's read again verses 17 and 18. carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side and Jesus in the middle. Now, just in these two verses, John is bringing to our mind loads of Old Testament references about sacrifices and what is going on. For time, we won't look at them all, but we'll just pick out a few. So following the severe flogging that he would have received upon being handed over to the soldiers, Jesus was then made to carry the cross, or at least a wooden beam or part of it, through the streets of Jerusalem and then outside the city where he would be crucified. And this movement of going out of the city is significant. It would remind the Jewish readers of the law given to them by Moses in Leviticus 16 on what was called the Day of Atonement. Now, atonement is a word that just describes two things. It describes a ransom from death, and it describes a purification, so making something which is unclean clean. And so it would happen in this way. You'd have a substitution, a swap for something clean and unclean. So an animal would come, it'd be without spot or blemish, a picture of being clean, of cleanness, and the person, the unclean person, who needed to be forgiven. And what would happen is that they would swap. The animal would be killed, and the person would not. And so that's what would make that person clean, because his uncleanness would go to the animal. And in particular, on the Day of Atonement, we read in Leviticus 16, this is what they had to do. In the bull for the sin offering and the goat for the sin offering, whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place, shall be carried outside the camp. Their skin and their flesh and their dung shall be burnt up with fire. So the animal has become dirty and is taken outside the camp, is removed from the camp where it is destroyed. And that's what we see in the Lord Jesus. Jesus takes on our uncleanness and then it's taken outside the camp, outside the city, to be destroyed. He is the sacrifice. Or think back to Genesis 22. Abraham is leading Isaac up a hill, a mountain called Moriah, which went on to be where Jerusalem was built. And what is Isaac carrying on his shoulder? Well, he's carrying the wood for the sacrifice that he is going to be laid on. But at the last minute, God provides a substitute, a swap again, a ram to be sacrificed in the place of Isaac. Well, what we're seeing here is the same thing. Jesus is carrying the wood to this place with the wood for his own sacrifice. But obviously the difference here is that he is that substitute. He is the one who is being sacrificed instead of us. And he is the one who is doing this willingly, choosing death for himself. And where does that lead him? Well, in verse 18, he is crucified, and with him two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. A direct echo to what we read just earlier in Isaiah 53. He poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many. That was his choice. That was his plan. So our sin is so serious that it requires death and nothing else will do. And yet he bore the sin of many and he did that willingly. Because this is not something that we can bear ourselves. And that's what shows us that the scandal of the cross was so necessary. Jesus to be the willing sacrifice, the one that we couldn't be. Now that's not something that we find naturally easy to get our heads around. It's not just children who have a very strong sense of fairness or unfairness, as it is often the case. We have a strong sense of earning things for ourselves. So earning a living, earning respect, earning forgiveness when we've wronged someone, making a restitution. And the problem with our sin is that we can never make amends for it. We could never earn our own forgiveness or fix it. Only Jesus can fix it. Only he, by being the sacrifice, by taking the punishment. And so those of us, even if we do trust in the Lord and joyfully accept this gift of life, well, there's something that we still struggle with. Think about the way you feel guilt. This time I've gone too far. Will God still be okay with me? Or maybe the flip side, think of the determination you have that next time you're going to get it right. That, you know, you'll do something and God will be impressed, pat you on the back. You know, you've met him halfway, as it were. Well, the scandal of the cross shows us that we take no part at all in our salvation. The only thing we contribute is our sin and our condemnation. Jesus does everything. Our salvation is entirely his work, his obedience, and his willing sacrifice. So do not think for a moment that you can do anything or contribute anything for your salvation. Even the smallest thing would rob Christ of what he has done. I remember as a young boy, there was a time, this really troubled me, because I knew that Christ had died for me and that I could be forgiven, yet I remember losing sleep over this, aware that I wasn't good enough, that, you know, was I really saved? I just knew I needed to do more. Even the best of me wasn't enough, I knew that. And when I think back to that time, there's a sense where I think, yeah, I was right. I could never offer enough. But that's the point. It'll never be enough. He's the only one who could do it. Nothing I do will ever be enough. Salvation only comes through the perfect work and the willing sacrifice of Jesus. And that is why, because he has done this, his name is above all other names. That is why he is the king. And that's our third and final point. Jesus is the king. He is God's all-powerful king. The theme of the kingship of Jesus is not particularly new to this passage. It's been running throughout the whole of John's gospel and all the gospels. Indeed, if you think about the genealogies in some of the other gospels that make much about his royal descent, think about the men from the east who come saying, where is he who was born king of the Jews? Now, being born king, that's quite an unusual title if you think about it. Aaron King, well, he was 73 when he became king, so he was certainly not born king. I did some research online, and as far as I can tell, I don't know how reliable this is, but only three people in history have been born king. The first is Alfonso XIII of Spain. His father died before he was born. Unfortunately, the monarchy was abolished about 45 years later, so he didn't remain king forever. There's John I of France, back in the 14th century. So he was born king, but he only reigned for 5 days because sadly he died after 5 days. The most successful is probably Shapur II of 4th century Persia. Apparently he was even crowned before he was born because the crown was placed on his mother's belly. But even after 70 years, he did die a king, but shortly after his death, the empire came to nothing and his throne has not existed for 1.5 millennia. But what John is showing us about Jesus, who was born king, lived a king, and died a king, that his kingship motif is at its most prominent precisely in his death. So these three kings, well, their reigns ended maybe with death or abdication, but what we're seeing is Jesus, the king, at his most glorious precisely in his death. Let's read from verse 19. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Many of the Jews read this sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. Now, why does Pilate write this notice? It was perfectly normal to put a notice with a crime on the cross. So why does he say King of the Jews? Does he believe it? Well, remember in the trial, 3 times he declares him innocent of any crime. He actually wanted to release Jesus. He didn't want to have him crucified. But he'd been cornered by the chief priests, humiliated into doing what they wanted. And so he found himself unable to release him and so condemned him. And so this notice there is very much an act of revenge, him trying to have the final word against the chief priests. It's a way of mocking them. Here is your king, a battered man nailed to a cross, dying the death of a criminal among other criminals, a worthy king for you Jews. It tells them who's in charge, who has power over them. The chief priests, they are nothing to the might of Rome. But what he does on top of it is also write the very last thing that they want to see written. They spent all their time trying to deny the kingship of Jesus, deny his lordship, that he's king. And here it is being broadcast to the whole world to see. The Romans have rejected him. The chief priests have rejected him. And just notice the way he calls them the chief priests of the Jews. I mean, he doesn't have to tell us. Nowhere else in the Gospels does he say of the Jews. It's obvious. But it brings out the irony, the chief priests of the Jews who have rejected the king of the Jews. They've rejected their own king, the very king they should be worshipping. So instead of worshipping him, the whole world, and that's us too, conspires against him, and yet the truth is proclaimed about who Jesus is. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And what we see there is God's hand overruling in creation so that it would go according to his plan. And by the way, that's the doctrine of providence right there that John is showing us. The loving Creator God orientating the events of history in an ordered, not a random reality. They're not beyond his control. Jesus did not end up there unwilling and by accident. They were driven by divine love. God had planned every detail. Calvin puts it really well with these words. He controls the tongues and the hands of unbelievers for the benefit of his own. The world rejects Jesus. And in doing this rejection, it cannot help but declare him king. But notice also what said something more, because this notice was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. Now, Aramaic, it's close to Hebrew. It would have been the language that they spoke in that the Jews would have spoken at that time. Latin was the official language of the empire, and Greek was the most commonly used language in the empire. So by using all three of these languages, anybody, pretty much anyone in the known world of the time would have been able to look at it and read it and see what was going on. And what this is signaling from God is that Jesus is not simply the king of the few, just the Jews, but he's the king of the many, the whole world. It shows us he is the universal king, the king crucified, lifted up for the world to see. His death is for everyone. So Jesus is God's all-powerful king. We already saw that sin required nothing short of this sacrifice. Christ's obedience and readiness to go through the sacrifice and God's provision in ensuring it happened exactly this way, the universal message, and that it points all to God's glory and power as well as his loving kindness towards us. And so just as we saw that the application should not be to think for a moment that we can do anything about our own salvation. Well, the flip side is true. So too, we shouldn't think that there is anything we can do that could prevent his work being effective for our salvation. There is nothing that can put us beyond his reach. Jesus, the King of the whole world, of all of us, died here for that. And so there's nothing we can do to wreck what he's done. So I told you about those fears I had as a boy. Well, I also had others that maybe my sin was too great. I knew my sin and that maybe it was just too much. Well, the crucified king tells us the opposite. He has done everything that is required. There is nothing I can add and there is nothing I can do to prevent it. And that's what gives us this assurance. For on the cross, another invisible note was nailed with Christ. Let me read you as we finish what Paul wrote to the Colossians. God made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by cancelling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. So that's the requirements because of our sin. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. So our sin has been nailed to the cross, as it is outside the camp, outside the city, that we may be clean. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, as we look to the cross, would we see the shock, the outrage, of seeing your king crucified? Would we see that it is our sin that put him there? That it required it? There was nothing else that would do? And would we marvel all the more at the willingness with which Jesus went to it? May it give us an assurance for the future. How great is your name, O God. Amen.